invisible under the glass, and your body was actually adding the capacity of it. So you had large squares, and you had to move your finger far away in order to see the difference. Nowadays, we just move it and slide it, and that changes, actually makes the touch screen working, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, you're talking about one of the two major methods of touch control, the screen. People with amateur radio gear, for the most part, have to deal with a resistive screen in which two conductive materials are put next on top of each other, and applying pressure shorts them out, and the resistance can be calculated into a location. Whereas our iPhones and iPads and such use a more sophisticated capacitive touch device. The problem with that is using a plastic pen isn't going to actuate it, because you need something like an organic finger to capacitively couple. So there are pens designed specially for that that have require a battery. There are gloves that have little contacts to couple them to your skin. So, fascinating subject, touch-sensitive technology.
Yep. In an oscilloscope, we have high-voltage probes, but not only in an oscilloscope. In some older versions of multimeters, we had a huge big probe that could work for 40,000 volts, and we could measure the voltage. The newer ones are much smaller. They are mostly limited to 1,000, 2,000 volts, but the principle is exactly the same. So those are capacitive voltage dividers, where you have one capacitor, huge capacitor connected, and then in series to it, you have a very small one. And the tip of the connected last capacitor, this very, very, very small capacitor in series with it, has two leads that are connected to the volt, to the voltmeter, right? And that's how it works. Also in oscilloscope, Dr. Roy.
Okay, I have nothing to add up to that.
Okay. So the rule of voltage divider is extremely important in everything we use. So how that is important to us, because not everybody of us is digging in electronics and PCB boards. Not everybody needs that knowledge, but at least to know that I'm touching the screen and I'm actually adding my capacitance to it, or I'm just squeezing the two materials together that change the capacitance of the circuit. Now, there's something like a flow detector. So you have a sensor that is on the floor, and when there is a water, it is shorting two pins, and there is an alarm. But in reality, not always the water is dirty, and not always the resistance of the water is so small, the voltage divider is being used there too. So the more modern forms of flow detectors or the moisture detectors, some of the people have a moisture detector in their garden or the plant, is made on the voltage divider, Dr. Roy.
Okay. Usually the ones that I saw look like they're just foils with spaces, and the idea is the water usually has some contamination, so the voltage, so the resistance drops when it's dry to what it's water. Does it do anything else?
When you have a voltage divider made on capacitors, it has a certain range of the capacitance, and if it uses the AC voltage, then the impedance changes. So we could have microprocessors that is actually sensing how much of the float how much of the moisture we have at a given time point of time, Dr. Wright.
Yeah, but what's the mechanism? Is the dielectric getting wet? I'm a little confused because, again, most of the obvious water detectors are just open circuits with some conducting material and an area to get wet by the water to drop the resistance. So I think we're talking about two different devices.
The capacitor is being charged based on the conductivity of the water that is shorting the pins of the flow detector, if we're talking about the flow detector. Now, because that factor is not always known, the capacitor is being charged to a certain level. So then the level of charge on the capacitor is giving us the output voltage on another capacitor in voltage divider connected to in series, and that is being directed to the simple logic that is able to see how much in given time, how many pulses do you have in a given time if you change it from analog to digital. And then counting the number of pulses is actually giving us the number of the level of load, or if we're dealing with moisture, the level of moisture. And to XGA.
Okay. I would just assume that the level of contamination would have a dramatic effect. If you poured distilled water on this thing, would it still go off?
Yes, it is. On the moisture or the float sensor, there are sometimes floats, the older version of the alarm panel, so float sensor, they have sensitivity regulator that gives you a certain range of the sensitivity. So sometimes in some commercial application, you could have 5 inches of water on the sensor and still doesn't react. So it either acts on the conductivity of the water or the level of the water on it. But the microprocessor is the one that actually determines what to do with the signal.
Okay, I just think that there's probably easier ways to accomplish simple, whether you have a leak or don't have a leak, where you just deal directly with the change in resistance as opposed to reactants and capacitance and all kinds of things. I don't know. There's more than one way to skin a cat, I'm sure, but just the easiest way to kind of think in terms of a leak detector is just two conductors with a space between them and an area where the water could collect and produce a lower resistance. And just to have the resistance be the trigger for whatever the alarm would be, but okay.
Well, what is important is the level of accuracy. So if we have, we could have extremely precise reading. So let's say you have a voltage. You have a 40,000 volts, up to 45,000 volts, and on your multimeter you want to read that voltage. It could go anywhere from 0 to 40,000 volts. And you know exactly if it's 22,550 volts. And based on the charge on the capacitor, the reading capacitor, because you have two capacitors, one that is connected to the high voltage source, and the cross of it, you have your output to the meter. That number of charge is much smaller than the charge on the big capacitor. That's why it's not getting problems. And you to have a proper calibration for it. So the same story is with the moisture detection or flow detection or any other detection or fluid detection or temperature detection could be also operated with voltage divider. Back to you.
Okay, I was just thinking in terms more of home use than industrial use, where you don't really need high accuracy. You just need to know if your basement has been flooded.
much not complicated device that doesn't have a voltage divider. It is for the sensor, for the home use, connected to the alarm system. You have a two pins, copper two pins, and one PCB and nothing else on it, two wires. And if the water comes, it shorts two pins, and then you have a normally closed contact instead of normally open. The problem with this is that if you have a fairly clean water, it's not going to be contacting. So you're going to have a flow, then you're not going to know about it. Dr. Roy.
Okay, I mean, I guess it depends on a series of factors. If you have water above the level of the detector, you're going to get the detector's response. The only difference is if you have great drainage, or if for some odd reason you place your detector on a high point in the floor. Because, as long as you got a flood and it's below the flood line and it's working, you should get some kind of response from it, I would think.
You're right, you should, but distilled water is not conductive. And if we have water that has, it's close, I'm not saying it's distilled water, but it's not very much conductive, then the response of the detector could be very coming late, too late.
Okay, but again, I'm not really thinking in terms of industrial design. I'm thinking more of domestic. And in domestic, I have no way that I would have a deionized distilled water flood. I have maybe a gallon of it sitting under my cabinet. It's not going to really flood anything. So in practical terms, in most domestic settings, people don't have deionized floods. They have a regular water supply that has a lot of dissolved calcium and other ions that have a resistance nowhere near what distilled water is.
Yes, I agree with that. One of the applications for high commercial use is 500 kilovolts. Capacitive voltage divider. It's a coaxial capacitive voltage divider that permits measurement of that 500 kilovolts voltage. And usually it is in insulating oil, and electricians working on high voltage power lines could use it. But I'm not sure. We probably have electricians listening to us. What is the voltage on the high voltage power line?
WS2N, I always thought it was around about 13,000 in the street, on top of the poles. But then the high voltage ones, like over 200,000 volts.
Okay. So, we can continue, but our space professional is waiting, so I think it's a time to wrap it up. Dr. Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Wesley. Thanks to everyone else who participated tonight. I want to remind people that if you want to contact me for mailbag questions, topics for discussion, puzzlers, or to ask Paul to take a look at something, email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com. The audio stream of the repeater is technet.ac2gs.com. And, of course, MikeKC2NJI's archive site, amateurradio.tv, that has archives of the technical net going back to September of 2006. And, of course, if you want to contact Paul, WS2N, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. And thanks to everyone. I'll be back at around 11 o'clock to say goodnight to everyone. I hope, Paul, that you include at least a small bit of the story of the Russian Space Agency's desire to spacejack that German X-ray telescope.
I don't have that one, Roy. I see it, but I didn't have time to include that.
Oh, okay. It's our friend at Roscosmos, the Rogozin, the guy who can't keep his mouth shut. He threatened the Germans to turn on a machine they turned off, and chances are no one's going to follow that advice because they're concerned that if they do it without the Germans' approval and assistance, they'll break the machine. So I just thought it was a fun Rogozin story again.
Yeah, Dmitry is a little out there. You know, before him, they had, you know, regular guys that handled the space program. But then Putin put this guy in, and it's been downhill ever since. This is the same guy that said that, well, you know, he won't allow us to commute anymore on his Soyuz spacecraft. If we want to get to the International Space Station, we could bounce on a trampoline.
Yes, in more polite situations, you call that type of a person a character. When the FCC isn't listening, there's probably more descriptive terms.
Understood. Yeah. Sooner or later, he'll be out. Somebody else will be in, hopefully. Because nothing but trouble. He's the one that blamed the Sierra, what's her name? It's got a last name. Anyway, she woman astronaut, he said that she's the one that drilled a 10-millimeter hole in the orbital module of the Soyuz spacecraft, which was bizarre. I mean, you know, this guy's got to go. It's a shame that we're dealing with them, but, you know, time changes everything, right?
Yeah, we just need some patience and some good luck that nothing terrible happens between then and now.
I concur. Okay. Very good. Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. The TechNet odometer turned over from the 1800s to 1900. It was 1899 last week. Now we're exactly 1900. So Dick would be happy to know that we carried on for the last couple of years, over 2.5 years since he's gone. Well, let's see, 2 years and I guess 3 months. But pretty good. And since I've been keeping records for the SpaceNet report, this is number 500 for me. And Roy's getting close to 300, and life goes on. This WS2N, does anybody have any questions? Because, you know, I have a list of things I can go through regarding the space program. I think I have enough time. By the way, I'm going into Glen Oaks again, because I noticed the signal changed the... My S-meter went up higher as you guys were talking, so I switched over. But if the signal goes downhill, Roy, just let me know. It takes me about 20 seconds to swing my beam around and go the other direction. Anyway, the James Webb Space Telescope, which we covered day after day, many, many nets here, is doing fine where it is. It's out at the L2 position. That puts it roughly 1 million miles away from Earth, four times the distance away from the Moon. And it's in a halo orbit. It was launched Christmas Day of last year. And it's taken a month or so to get to its proper location now, many more months to... fine-tune all the electronics and get it ready to actually send science back. but they, you know, they have detectors on this thing. They could tell any little movement or any type of thing that happens to this telescope. They really thought everything out, and they found out a small micrometeorite hit one of the 18 gold-plated mirrors. You know, the space telescope is 21 feet in diameter, and they have these mirrors. Each mirror is in a hexagon form, and they all work together as one. They adjusted every single one of them to make it perfect. Where you know, if you were looking at one little star, that dot would be dead center. It started off, you know, 18 different locations, and they brought everything back. And so they can tell where the mirrors are and what kind of improvements they need to do, you know, as the time goes on. And then even as the years go on, they'll be able to readjust it if necessary. Well, one of the mirrors, actually they reported was C3 got hit with a micrometeorite. You know, they have designations, you know, there's they start in the middle, and they go around the center. Center, of course, does not have one. does not have a mirror. That's where the light goes through, and then gets picked up by the tertiary mirror, and then it gets sent to the detectors. But they label every single mirror. You know, there's A1, A2, and there's six of them going around the center, and then there's a whole bunch that they go around on the outside. And one of them is C3. If you're looking at it, it's the bottom right-hand side. It got toward the outside. It got hit with a micrometeorite, and larger than what they planned for. They knew it would get hit with stuff as the time went on, but this was a little bit bigger than what they figured on. They figured it's like maybe just the size of a grain of rice. And you would think it would screw up the whole deal, but no, it's I guess it's similar to looking at your phone, and you have, you know, fingerprints all over your phone, but that has virtually no effect on, you know, what you're seeing when you look through when you're looking at that phone. Pictures look great. Well, they said there's really no degradation that's going to go on. They can correct it if they need be. I think they did move it a little bit, the C3 mirror. So, interesting. They're expecting great pictures back. I think they said the 12th of July is going to be the first science pictures that come back. We'll see. We'll talk about it on that when it gets released, that's for sure. Any comments or questions? WS2X. Nothing hurt. I gave Echo a good chance. I think I left enough of a break there. Now, next December, NASA's going to test out a new inflatable heat shield that they want to use eventually for landing heavy loads on Mars. And this thing, it's evolved. I remember talking about this when they first started testing this thing. They call it a LOFTID, LOFTID, which is a low Earth orbit flight test and inflatable decelerator. But anyway, we covered this back in 2012, actually, when they started developing it. And the idea is to, you know, you need a gigantic heat shield to land in certain atmospheres like Mars or even Earth. Earth, we don't have too much of a trouble slowing down. You know, we have on Earth, where we are, 14.7 pounds per square inch up higher. You get up to 100,000 feet, and you have like one-tenth of maybe 1% of what we have here on Earth. Well, that happens to be around the same pressure as what you have on the ground on Mars. but still it's pressure. So they use heat shields to enter Mars. We've done that successfully a number of times, of course. But the biggest ones we've been able to send up was like the Curiosity and Perseverance riding around those robots. Robots now have successfully landed, but, you know, one of them is almost 2,000 pounds. Perseverance is around 2,250 pounds. But to get those heavy units to land on Mars, you use a very big heat shield, and this was around 16 feet. It was bigger than what they used for the Apollo, you know, this big heat shield. But it was the biggest one that they could fit inside of a 17-foot diameter fairing on top of a rocket. You know, you could only make these fairings on top of the rocket so big, and that's it. They need some bigger than, you know, 21 feet would be good, you know, 21 or maybe even a little larger. You could land not one ton on Mars. You could land, they said, the equivalent of 20,000 pounds on Mars, 10 times the amount that you get. Now, you're going to need that, you know, for when humans decide to go to Mars, and you're going to need all the support equipment. You're going to need not one ton items, you're going to need 10 times that amount. So you need to get through the atmosphere, and they plan on using these deaccelerators, which they plan to test one in December. They consist of a series of rings, inflated rings. So, you know, you have a smaller one, and then another one that's a little larger, another one a little larger, and they manage to attach these things to one another, and you wind up with this cone that's, you know, roughly 21 feet long in diameter, and then they coat it with a material to resist the heat, and they say when it inflates, it's like steel. I mean, this thing is very solid. So they've tested it successfully in the lab. Back in 2012, we talked about it, and they tested it on the ground. They wanted to see how it would go. They put a rocket on a sled, and they pulled this thing, and they wanted to see if it would open, you know. They tried that, and then they actually sent one into suborbital flight. They wanted to see what it was like actually up in the atmosphere. Like I said before, 100,000 feet gives you, you know, one one-hundredth of atmosphere of Earth, which is very similar to Mars. And they wanted to see if they could open it, and if they could, you know, if it would come apart, you know, by the time it landed on Earth. And they tested it from Wallops Island, Virginia. They launched on a suborbital rocket. It went up, it got to proper height, and then started coming back down. And then they had a rocket in the center of this thing. They wanted to duplicate the speed that it would be coming through it on Mars. So, you know, rather than just let it start accelerating after the engine shut off from the rocket, this thing had a solid rocket on board to really accelerate this thing as it was flying down through the atmosphere to test it. And it was successful, so they knew it would work. So all these years later, they finally come up with this final design, which they actually want to test from orbit. So they're going to launch it on a Falcon, they're going to launch it on a Boeing Lockheed ULA Atlas V rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. So they're going to actually put it into orbit. They actually have another mission that they're flying. It's a ride-sharing mission. They're going to have these two payloads go up. So they'll put the one payload to its proper higher altitude, and this one on a lower altitude. But it will be in orbit, and it will be flying at 17,500 miles an hour. If it was entering Mars' atmosphere, would be around 13,000 miles an hour. So this will be a good test. If it works out at that speed, you know, they'll be okay, especially for Mars. So I'm looking to see how that works out. The reason I'm talking about it is that they packed it all up, they compressed it, it'll fit inside the fairing of an Atlas V rocket, and we'll see if this thing opens up correctly. And if it's successful, they could land extremely heavy things. You know, you can put, you know, my house, would the weight of the house would probably make it down to the Martian surface. The problem is, like the two rovers that we landed, those things are, they can't even get to the equivalent of sea level on Mars. They actually have to go to lower areas, like go to Death Valley. They have to go a kilometer below the equivalent of sea level because they need the extra distance to actually continue to slow down, between the heat shield, and then they open it up with a parachute, and then even after that, they have the sky crane that comes out and lowers the vehicle to the surface. You wouldn't be, even with what we have today, you wouldn't be able to put that on the equivalent of ground level on Mars or on top of a hill or a mountain. You just don't have that space. You would run out of space. But with the deaccelerator, you could put this thing anywhere. You can also use it for sending heavy objects back from, say, from the space station. You know, you can make smaller ones or bigger ones. You can, they have a lot of heavy things that they might want to send back from the space station. You put it on one of these and just let it drop through the atmosphere. So, any questions or comments? WS2N.
Paul?
Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I didn't actually have a question. I just thought I could kick the echo link back into the audio, but it's not coming back as easy as it usually does. So I've tried a few different methods of kicking it.
Okay, suppose we just unkey. Usually that works, no?
Well, you got to finesse it a little bit. The last time that you keyed, it came back. So that was after a couple of keying and unkeying. So now it's working.
Okay, it's working, but nothing hurt. Okay, anybody have any questions or comments before we continue? Okay, another topic is these fast radio bursts have been showing up for astronomers, picked up by radio telescopes. One that they wrote about was the, they call it the FAST telescope, the one that's 1,500 feet diameter in China. Well, we used to have something like that at Arecibo, but that was heavily damaged during Hurricane Maria, and then eventually the whole thing tended to collapse, the whole centerpiece came tumbling down and crashed through the through it. Anyway, they've scrapped Arecibo. But China has one, and they're picking up these fast radio bursts from like 3 billion light years away. Let's say miles. 3 billion light years away. And they've picked these things up before. I think 2007 or so, they first discovered these things. And they're not really sure exactly what they are. But they put out as much power in a split second, they said, as if you had the sun's energy, what if the sun puts out for 100 years. That's how much energy gets pushed out by this thing. So they're still trying to figure out whether it's neutron stars, whether it's something to do with the black holes. But they're working on it. And the reason they talk about this one is because this one reoccurs. It keeps coming back. All the previous ones that they've detected, it'll come on and then it'll shut off. And they used to use like the Swift telescope, which detects signals, that are from these types of things. It would hurry up and point in that direction. because they knew they had a certain amount of time to pick up a signal, you know, after the aftermath of it. And anyway, they're working on what this is. I don't have that much information on it, as you can tell, but, you know, to have something reoccurring, I mean, it's not an old green man, but it's something that's occurring in nature. And in between these are fast radio bursts, there's radio signals that are also coming in, you know, on a regular basis that the FAST telescope is picking up. So scientists have a new dilemma. Maybe they'll come up with another theory, new particles. Who knows what they're going to come up with, but it should be interesting. Of course, it takes time to get these answers. It might take years. We'll see. They detected more than 500 bursts have been spotted over the years, but only 5% are reoccurring. So they're going to try to figure out what these are. They'll probably just classify it as, you know, a different type of fast radio burst, you know, one, a reoccurring one. You know, they'll give it an acronym or something. But looking forward to see what these things are eventually. Let me drop it before we move on to another topic, if anybody has any questions. Okay, I know this was on the news, CNN, and, you know, I think I even saw it on Channel 2 News, local news. They talked about UFOs that NASA is now studying again. You know, years ago they had something called Project Blue Book, and went back in the, I guess, 50s or so, and they would take all these reports that people were seeing flying saucers, and they'd be recorded, and over time, there was no proof of anything. They could explain what some of these objects were. The ones that were unexplainable, they just called UFOs, unidentified flying objects. And eventually, they stopped with the Blue Book studies, and they just became actually became classified for years. And then eventually, they released it. And nothing was ever made of it. Now they're going to call these flying objects. They're going to call them UAPs. So, when in doubt, I guess change the name, unidentified aerial phenomena. So they're going to call these things that we've called UFOs since I was born. But hopefully, they can figure out what. You know, what's going on. There's plenty of little pictures, black and white pictures and grainy pictures. Fortunately, all these decades later, nobody brought back a piece of spacecraft. Nobody brought back a finger from a crash landing that, you know, from a little green man. There hasn't been one piece of evidence, physical evidence that's ever come back. Plenty of people have talked about abductions and this and that. You know, when they were there, couldn't they, like, you know, take a stethoscope or something off the table that they were getting examined by? You know, when they came back to Earth, they could have showed somebody. You know, I got this from the spaceship. Well, there's not any evidence of it whatsoever. But, they, you know, there are pictures, and I'm sure they could all be explained. If enough money is poured into what they're doing. So I guess NASA's going to start pouring some more money into it to further investigate these things. We'll have to see. I don't know if anybody saw this on the news, but, you know, to help satisfy the public's interest, there's plenty of people that are saying, you know, what is this? And how come it's unknown? And you're not telling us about it. So I guess they're going to make a lot of people happy. WS2S. I hope they do find a little green man one day. I mean, that would be, you know, that would be the top news. I guarantee that. I don't know for how long, you know, the news cycle probably would change really quick. you know, on how long they would, the news would last there with one story about the little green man. They would have to find a lot of green men. Ingenuity is still flying on Mars. That's the good news. You know, we sent the UFO to Mars. Many UFOs. We put many things into orbit. Not only us, other countries, India, China. We have European Space Agency has the Mars Express. Even India, like I said, India has one. Even the UA, United Arab Emirates, the Hope spacecraft going around Mars. So we have our own UFOs going around these planets. But I don't think there's too many organisms down on Mars to see this stuff in orbit. But we could see a lot of things from orbit and from the planet itself. Landed plenty of rovers on Mars. We landed Pathfinder in the 1990s, Spirit, Opportunity. Rode around for 14 years. Spirit for 6. Curiosity, nuclear powered. This other one, Perseverance, nuclear powered, riding around. Ingenuity was brought up by Perseverance. That's the helicopter. They were hoping it would fly 5 different times on Mars. You know, they were pushing their luck if they could make it to 5. Last March when we reported on this, they made it up to 21. Now they're up to 28 flights for Ingenuity. So talking about Ingenuity, the people that came up with this thing, they sure had it. And it's still functioning. They're going to let it sit for a while because they're going into a lot of dust being formed in the atmosphere to cloud the solar panels. They're also going into winter, which is less sunlight for a period of time, you know, many months to come. So I think they're going to leave it for a couple of months before they fly again. Each flight was more and more dramatic. They went higher, and they've gone faster, further. And, you know, SpaceX talks about reusability. They ain't got nothing on this. This thing is a helicopter flying on Mars from a control room in JPL and flying 28 times and still at it. Any questions? WS2N. Okay, we did have one failed launch this weekend. Actually, it was today. It's a company called Astra. Their goal is to put a small payload into orbit with a small rocket. And the rocket is only 45 feet tall. Runs on regular, you know, rocket kerosene, RP-1, rocket propellant 1, and liquid oxygen. And a launch out of launch complex 46 in Florida. And, you know, they launched a number of times in Kodiak, Alaska, and now in Florida a couple of times. Unfortunately, this mission failed. Booster worked good, as it has in a couple of the other flights. This is Astra's 7th time to get their rocket into orbit. Second stage, that was supposed to take it to orbit. It ignited, but then flamed out, and that was it. That's all she wrote. Lost the second stage and lost the payload. It was supposed to do 2 more of these flights in the next couple of months, which would have been good. I mean, especially for hurricane season. The payload was called Tropics, which stands for Time Resolved Observations of Precipitation Structure and Storm Intensity with a Constellation of Small Sats. You know, I wrote that down. Anyway, they're called the Tropics. They were supposed to launch three of these missions within, you know, a month or so. And this was the first. And what it would do at the 300 mile high orbit would be taking data and, you know, from any cyclones that are out in the Atlantic. So, unfortunately, it didn't work. So try again. The reason NASA gave it to them, they came in at the lowest price. Naturally, they beat SpaceX and ULA and a couple of the other companies that haven't made it to orbit yet, Firefly, Relativity. But they'll try again. I hope they make it next time. More rockets, the better. You know, we'll see how they do. And that's called Astra. Any comments or questions? Okay, another company with problems. I think they're going to fix it pretty quick is SpaceX. Last week they were supposed to have CRS-25. It was supposed to go up to the space station. It was supposed to bring 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of food and material to the space station, but it's been delayed. When they filled this vehicle, it's been up to the space station a number of times. It's reusable, but when they refueled the vehicle, they detected a leak. They have, you know, in the not the rocket itself, but in the spacecraft itself, which uses monomethylhydrazine. And it also uses, you know, that for the fuel, and nitrogen tetroxide for the oxidizer. You know, they have two different tanks. When they mix it, they don't use a spark plug. It just ignites. It's you know, I mean, it's has been around, of course, since the Apollo days. When we landed the LEM on the moon, there were hypergolic reactions as well. But for some reason, there's a leak in their system. A week or so ago, they drained the whole system. And I'm sure they're probably testing it with nitrogen, probably looking for leaks and finding out what the problem is. But as of yet, I don't think that they have found the problem. Which puts a problem on not only delivering cargo, but future crews to the space station. They don't want to fly Dragon unless this is corrected. Last thing you need is a leak in a crew vehicle going up to the space station. As it is, you have a crew four with a Dragon attached to the space station, about ready to come back in a few months. But I'd like to pinpoint that and make sure this is not systemic throughout the different vehicles that they do have. Hopefully not, and they can fix it. You know, that's why you need backups. You know, right now we're a step away from having another crew vehicle being certified by NASA called Starliner, being built by Boeing, which successfully a couple weeks ago just went up to the space station and came back back to New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico. Very successful flight. You know, they have some problems to iron out, but it looks good. The next flight would contain a crew, and that's what NASA needs. And, you know, they had it right from the beginning. You know, you need two different companies, two different spaceships that work differently. In case something goes wrong with one, you have the other one. Starliner was supposed to be flying a couple of years ago, so we had SpaceX, you know, pick up the slack. But now SpaceX might have a
time complete.
You know, now we have Boeing and Starliner. I hope that, you know, they get both of these vehicles up and running. Any comments or questions as they come to the grinding halt of 11 o'clock for tonight's SpaceNet report for the TechNet? Nothing heard. We'll turn it over to you, Roy. Good night tonight. And the radio's held together, so that's good. Tomorrow night we have more radio fun with the Radio Club InfoNet. And that will be up on this repeater at 8:30, followed by news, followed by Swap and Shop, and then Newsline. AC2GS, WS2N, back to you.
Yes, indeed, this is AC2GS. Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do during the technical net. Thank you for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And thanks to those people that participated tonight and to all the other people who apparently are busy doing something else someplace else. Please come back. We miss you. Anyway, I gave you the links. I gave you all the usual stuff. I'll remind you, Dick would usually end the technical net and ask everyone to be kind to each other. I think that's always good advice, but nowadays it's particularly good advice. Be good to each other. Be nice. Play nice. You're supposed to have fun. You're not supposed to make each other angry and upset and what have you. So just want to leave you with a new favorite quote of mine. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So think about that. Roll that around in your mind. This is AC2GS calling formally an end to this episode of the Limewire Technical Net. I hope you all come and join me again next Sunday night when we try and do it all over again. So goodbye, and have a good week. Enjoy yourselves, and we'll see you again down the road. This is AC2GS, and I am clear.
Yeah, Paul, if you're still there, WB2BX.
WB2BXO. Hello, Frank, WS1.
Yeah, I tried to get in before you closed the net, but I think there's a cross conversation here. You might not have heard my audio. In any case, I'm not sure if you covered it, because I had to run out for a minute. Did you talk about the Chinese spacecraft that put an HF receiver on the backside of the moon to see what they'd hear, only to find they have an RFI problem with their power supply? That's kind of amusing, isn't it?
I didn't talk about that subject, but I did read about it, yeah. That's, what is it, Chang 5? Yeah, that's, it landed at, I think that's a year and a half ago. And then it had, you know, it had the, what were they going to do? I'm trying to remember what they were going to use for an antenna. Anyway, they were going to look at the stars, you know, look at, see what they could copy with no, no interference whatsoever. Meanwhile, they got local interference from their own equipment. Somebody to put a filter on that, I guess, Frank.
Yeah, well, I know, and I think it's power supply noise from the photovoltaic cell, if I remember correctly, and it's a specific kind of interference, so they may be able to filter it out in software, but still, it's kind of amusing. Considering all the problems we sometimes have with switching supplies and et cetera, causing problems, to spend all that money to put a receiver, an SDR, on the backside of the moon, only to find there's too much noise from a power supply and you can't hear anything.
Okay. Now I have a small solar panel I can charge things with. Backyard. If I plug it into a radio, AM radio, not FM, an AM radio, you could hear the bad clicking. You know, it's bad. You got FM and it works. I guess the capture effect, the FM signal is stronger than the local effect, but. Chinese aren't going to have that kind of luck, you know. They're getting total noise. So how would they fix it? Do you think they can fix it with software? That would be good.
know, but, you know, it's a specific kind of noise, and which is probably fairly easy to duplicate on the ground, and once you know the exact pattern, I would think that it would be possible to filter out with some signal processing, no?
Oh, okay. You know, like we do with Whisper and all that, you know, FT8, you know, the signal that they're looking for coming from the heavens, that's, well, I don't know, that would have to be loud enough. I mean, it would really have to be, I mean, who knows how many, it could be 150 dB, that difference that they're looking to receive, I don't know. I haven't read any of the technical stuff. I'm surprised they released any technical stuff on it. I'm surprised they released the information that'll be working. You know, they're pretty closed-mouthed over there.
Yeah, I know. That aspect of it, you know, seems kind of counterintuitive that they release some information. I think part of it is they like the hams to download some of their signals because it's a cheaper way to have a tracking network. And also, I guess, get some other people to give them observations, whatever. Anyway, you know, they do, you know, it's, I guess, kind of hard to figure out what they're, you know, what they're doing. It seems reasonable. It seems random to us, but I guess there's a certain logic to them.
Okay. Went through all that trouble, you know, they have a, I mean, it did other things, you know, pictures, and, testing the soil, yeah, regolith. I mean, other things have been successful, but that part of their mission, looking at the galaxy, is not working out. The signals are transmitted to another satellite. They thought ahead, you know, they put a satellite behind the moon that they're, you know, it's in an extremely high halo type of orbit. And that satellite is being used as a repeater, you know, because it's behind the moon, they can't transmit back to Earth. So they're transmitting up to the satellite. I think the satellite is 40,000 kilometers away, pretty far. And it's transmitting to that, and that in turn turns around and sends the signal back to Earth. So we'll have to, you know, duplicate, when it comes back to Earth, duplicate the noise that they get, filter that out. Yeah, that might work. I agree, Frank.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I know. I think they have the satellite. They're doing what I think we intend to do with the Lunar Gateway and our comm satellites. It's a so-called rectilinear orbit, where apparently it's a polar orbit where satellite can view some of the backside of the moon, as well as have a line of sight to the Earth. I think that's what they're doing anyway. They're doing some interesting stuff. Been watching For All Mankind, by the way. I'm sure you probably watched that kind of interesting alternate history. Go ahead.
Okay. I think in a couple of months, maybe less than that, we're going to launch. Rocket Labs are going to launch Capstone to the moon, and it's going to go into that rectilinear orbit. They want to see how it functions up there. Of course, you know, that's where we're going to put the Gateway space station. And For All Mankind, well, I've read the books, and apparently there's, I remember seeing that on TV. Are they replaying it, or did they make an updated version of it? Back to you, Frank. WS1.
No, there are three seasons of it now on Apple Plus, so, you know, you For the time being, anyway, you have to pay Apple Plus to see it, but it's very, very good. It'll probably make its way to free.